Hi, guys. Thank you for your continued support of the Paleo Solution Podcast. I also wanted to take a moment and thank two of our wonderful podcast sponsors. The first is Thrive Market. Thrive is a new online marketplace offering the world's best-selling natural and organic products at wholesale prices. If Costco and Whole Foods Online got together at a rave and got liquored up, their child would look a lot like Thrive Market. So the way that Thrive works, for less than $5 a month, about $59.95 annually, you get a membership that gives you access to more than 2,500 of the highest quality food, supplement, home, personal care, and beauty products. Those are all delivered straight to your door and at 25 to 50% below retail price. Orders above $49 ship free, but that's only in the continental United States. RobWolf.com followers get a free 2-month Thrive Market membership, as well as 20% off of your first order. So go to thrivemarket.com/RobWolf, and you can get in on that deal. Our second podcast sponsor is Hylete. I think most of you know that I'm a big fan of Hylete. I was an early adopter of their phenomenal athletic gear. They've been huge fans and supporters of all things paleo, all things Rob Wolf. So very grateful for those folks. They've come up with a really cool new program. If you go to hylete.com/RobWolf, then you will create an account where you'll receive a $25 gift code that you can use on your first purchase. You will always receive free shipping, and RobWolf.com listeners get exclusive pricing. So if you want to check them out, if you've already checked them out, but you want to get additional discounts, additional fantastic pricing, or if you are new to Hylete, go to hylete.com/ROBBWOLF and get signed up and give them a look-see. Hi, folks. Rob Wolf here with another edition of the Paleo Solution Podcast. Today's guest has been on the show before. He was incredibly popular. Dr. Mike Hart, very knowledgeable about ethnogens, cannabis, supplements, HRT. We talked a lot about female hormones last time. We're going to talk a little bit about male hormones today and another of other topics. Doc, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you doing, Rob?
All good. We're getting alternating snow and sun here in Reno, so you can't really complain too much about that.
Well, I'm in London, Ontario. We usually have some snow by now, but we actually don't have any right now. So I'm just loving this extended summer that we're having.
Yeah, I've heard that everybody on the East Coast is running kind of behind schedule on their polar vortexes and stuff like that. So
I got a big Canada Goose jacket, and I haven't brought it out yet. So I'm very, very happy that I haven't. We had it in the teens yesterday, so it's great.
Awesome. Awesome. Hey, Doc, remind folks a little bit about your background. You have a fantastic background spanning both medicine and athletics. Just remind folks a little bit about your background.
Sure. So in terms of my academic background, I have a Bachelor of Science in Nutritional Biochemistry from Memorial University. And then I completed my MD at Sabre University. And then I completed my family medicine residency at Western University in London, Ontario. And then since that time, most of my research has surrounded hormone replacement therapy. So I have a large hormone replacement therapy practice with both men and women. And then the other thing that I primarily do now is that I primarily see veterans that suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder, and I use cannabis to help treat that particular disorder with the veterans. So it's kind of a little bit about my academic background and what I'm up to right now. And then in terms of my athletics and things like that, right now I'm just a recreational hockey player. I'm training a little bit at Adrenaline. I'm actually training with Mark Homnick right now. And I'm doing just some weight training on my own, a little bit of cardiovascular conditioning. So nothing too serious, just kind of keeping everything up and mostly focusing on the academics of my career right now.
Awesome. Awesome. Cool. Yeah. Doc, how old are you?
I'm 31.
Oh, you're just a whippersnapper. I have ingrown hairs older than you. Okay, cool. So fantastic. Cool. So, Doc, last time you were on the show, we talked a significant amount about women's hormonal replacement therapy and kind of some of the ways that the female hormonal axes can be dysregulated. I've had people cranky at me in the past because I've not talked about that. But the reason why I don't talk about it is I don't neither know nor understand it that well. So I thought, oddly enough, that it was better for me not to commentate on something that I wasn't well-versed in, but I do have a little bit better of a steeping in male hormone replacement. It's a really controversial topic, like and I know, you know, some differences maybe between Canada and the U.S., but the U.S. is getting very prickly on this HRT topic, and, you know, I guess a lot of different points that we could jump in on this, but I guess first, you know, who are the folks that legitimately need hormone replacement therapy who are males? And then who are the folks that maybe are getting put on testosterone replacement inappropriately, like they needed to tackle diet, exercise, lifestyle factors, and that would have, you know, probably fixed what they had going on?
Yeah, well, I think it's a really good question, and it's a good question, and it's good timing actually, because we had some guidelines in Canada come out recently about TRT. So just to kind of break it up a little bit, Rob, there are some people who have documented low testosterone below the normal range, total testosterone and free testosterone, and those patients absolutely are suffering from a testosterone deficiency, and it would not only help their overall well-being and sex drive and things like that, but it's also would help starve off diabetes, obesity, and really anything metabolic. So that's kind of one group of people. And then there's a second group of people that the guidelines have just come out in Canada that say that you can treat someone who's low normal, that is, that's still expressing symptoms. So if someone has testosterone that's in the low normal range, and I really apologize how Canada and the U.S. have different values.
No, you don't apologize. The only apology that needs to happen is on my part, because we insist on using the only non-standardized international units on everything from linear measurement to volumetric measurement. So we're the bad kids in that thing.
Well,
so
I can help you out. I don't know if you're the bad kids, but I can help you out maybe a little bit with your readers on that note, because there's a great life extension article that has all the lab values, and it's in American values. Mm. So maybe we can attach that to this podcast. Okay. But coming back to the patients that that I usually see, so if someone is low normal but they're still have symptoms of testosterone deficiency, then it is okay to treat. But you need to determine as a physician or as a healthcare professional why this patient has low normal testosterone. And I've written articles, have been published in the Huffington Post and on Primal Docs that have stated 10 ways that how to keep your testosterone levels high. And if you can do that, then you should be able to keep going at least in your 30s or so to keep your testosterone levels peaked. Now, once you get older, and we can't really do anything about our testosterone level declining by 1% every year after the age of 27. We can't do anything about that. And sometimes in life too, there's so much stress and things going on that it's very difficult to follow some of the rules that I do put out, you know? So that's another group of patients. So the patients that are low normal, they should really be advised to try other lifestyle factors before actually be putting on TRT.
Gotcha.
Go ahead, Rob.
This may be too early to ask this, but you know, the normal values and even the normal range for folks, like I do some work with the military, and you see these guys who pre-deployment, they've got fantastic testosterone levels. Post-deployment, it's literally perhaps 5 to 10 times lower, but they still fall within, quote, the normal range. So within the Canadian guidelines, this would be a story, well, okay, the range is technically normal for the population, but they're still exhibiting signs and symptoms of inadequate testosterone levels, and so it would be appropriate to treat. The U.S. is still very prickly about that, and most doctors are particularly, you know, general practitioners are super prickly around that topic.
Yeah, and I understand why they are, because guidelines haven't come out and everyone is just basically trying to protect their ass, more or less.
Right.
But because, you know, these guidelines in Canada have come out recently, then it's actually up to us as physicians to decide whether or not to treat. And really, it's our duty right now, because it is within the guidelines to say to treat if someone is low normal and they do have symptoms. So it's not only something that we can do, it's something that we're really expected to do nowadays. I can't really comment too much on the US side. I don't know why, it's not maybe in, and I haven't seen US guidelines, but I would be very surprised if some of the US guidelines didn't follow some of the Canadian ones now that they have made that particular statement.
They may follow suit, but it's funny, there's a puritanical culture in the United States that is really antagonistic towards this stuff, and it gets into like sports doping and all this other jive, and it's really neurotic. But I mean, the US is just a neurotic teenager anyway on the best of days, so it's maybe not surprising. But I'm sorry I interrupted you were going into a third group of people that you're seeing in a clinical basis.
Yes, and then if you have someone who comes in and they have quote normal testosterone or normal high testosterone, that would not be someone who would be a candidate for testosterone replacement therapy. In that case, you would try to tease out their symptoms, and you would figure that their symptoms are coming from something else. So if it was coming from something like decreased muscle mass and not being able to decrease body fat, we know that that particular issue with that patient is not related to testosterone. We know it's related to something else. And then you'd have to look at your diet and different types of factors. So just to kind of like summarize, if someone who is absolutely low, then for sure you can go ahead and start that patient on TRT if they've documented total and low free testosterone. If you have someone, however, who is kind of low normal and they're still exhibiting symptoms, then that's the patient that could really benefit from your lifestyle factors. And then you have maybe a third group of patients that'll come in that really, even though they're coming in and you're not replacing or you're not giving them any testosterone, you can still help that patient by teasing out what the actual issue is. And by ruling out that testosterone is not the cause, you're already kind of helping that particular patient.
Gotcha. Yeah. Doc, how important are things like aromatase inhibitors to prevent an unwanted cascade of, say, testosterone into estrogen?
So I try to avoid to use aromatase inhibitors, mm-hmm. and really we should really talk about the dose just a little bit. So the PDR dose is so crazy and large. So it's between, it says 400 milligrams 50 to 400 milligrams every 2 to 4 weeks, right? So that's ridiculous. So at the top end, you're getting 400 milligrams every 2 weeks, and then at the lower end would be 50 milligrams every 4 weeks, right? So they're huge ranges. So if someone is injecting more than 100 milligrams of test at one time, then an aromatase inhibitor often is needed. But if they're injecting less than that, they're injecting less than 100 milligrams, aromatase inhibitor often isn't needed. But that's still, you can't just make even though I did make that statement, it's still not something that you can say for absolutely everybody, because if you have someone, say, who's a very obese person and they're taking testosterone, well, all that adipose tissue has that aromatase enzyme is going to convert testosterone to estrogen. So that patient would be much more likely to have a conversion. So what I'm trying to say is that you should avoid being on them as much as possible, and the best way to avoid being on an aromatase inhibitor if you're taking TRT is to lower your dose and to split your dose. So like guys who, there's some really old school methods of giving like 400 milligrams at once every like 4 weeks. That's just way too much at one time. Most of my patients run between 100 to 150 a week. And I got some guys even on less than like 75 milligrams a week. And we always split the dose to make sure that that patients are taking it twice a week instead of once a week. Now, some patients will even be taking it, like I said, every 2 weeks, every 4 weeks. But we know the half-life is only about 6 to 8 days or 11 days, depending on the study that you look at. But the way testosterone works is that it peaks at around 24 hours and then it stays there for 2 or 3 days and then it starts to level down. So if you kind of can just keep it at the peak range by giving a smaller dose twice a week, then you're certainly going to minimize the estrogen effects. Gotcha. But if you're going to be giving a large dose at once, like if someone's giving 400 at once, I mean, the next 2 or 3 days after, your testosterone is going to be through the roof, and they would absolutely need an aromatase inhibitor at that point.
Okay. And really, I mean, no, unless you're, for general health maintenance, longevity, really no argument for going super physiological on this stuff.
No. And you know, patients will say that they feel fine on a dose at 100 and 150 a week, which is not a huge mega dose of testosterone. And that's all that's really needed ever to replace.
Gotcha. Doc, do you do any tinkering with like trying to provide substrate for testosterone production and also things like HCG, like trying to turn that axis back on, doing like high dose DHEA plus Arimidex or you know, like a cycle of that plus DHEA, just to see if there's any way to turn the testes back on or turn that signaling back on?
Yeah, absolutely. And there are ways to do that. And there are a lot of off-label uses. And I haven't done it in my practice, but if I understand the question, I'd be really getting at like post-cycle androtherapy or really just trying to rev up the system again. And there is ways to do that. There's a very good protocol that requires HCG, Clomid, and tamoxifen. Now, I haven't used that in my office, but I know that it's something that's been documented in the literature. There's a doc online, Michael Scali, that uses it a lot. And we can go over that protocol if you want to, Rob.
Yeah, I find that interesting. Like in some of the folks that I've followed, Doc Parsley and some other people, you know, they, again, like within the military scene, in an effort to maybe not suppress, say, like the ability to have children in the future or something like that, they'll
Absolutely.
Try, you know, just turning the system back on and see if they can get it firing by using substrates like DHEA, using maybe some Arimidex to block, again, that conversion of DHEA into estrogen, and then also HCG or Clomid to try to, at the brain level, turn the testes back on.
Yeah, I know that Michael Scali's told me directly that he's had like 100% effective rate with this particular protocol of HCG, Clomid, and of tamoxifen. And you know, if we can go over the protocol if you want. The HCG is just it's a 30-day protocol. It's so it comes in a 10,000 IU bottle where you would give 300 IUs every third day, and then on day 21. Of that particular after using your HCG, which you would continue for the 30 days, but on day 21, that's when you start your Clomid and your tamoxifen, and you would take both of those for 45 days. Your Clomid would be at 50 milligrams, and tamoxifen would be at 20 milligrams a day, and those things will boost your LH and your FSH, and that'll help boost your testosterone again.
Doc, remind folks what HCG is and what is it try? So it's trying to mimic the effects of luteinizing hormone, and then remind folks what luteinizing hormone does.
Okay, so luteinizing hormone is going to send a signal to your testes to make testosterone. So when you're on testosterone replacement therapy, now I should say when you're on a testosterone replacement therapy, so I'm talking about a dose of, you know, at least under 200 milligrams a week. Generally, people don't get completely shut down in that range, but for those who do, if they've, you know, abused steroids or have done you know, higher doses, then you can completely shut down. And with that, HCG does help, and it can be very, very effective. So guys will use that not only when they are like post cycle, but they also, some guys use it during. And the only reason you would use it during is if you are someone who's using TRT and you're not, and you haven't had kids yet and you want to stay fertile, then HCG is a way to stay fertile. The other method is that, or the other reason to use it is it just helps grow the size of your testicles. Okay. So okay. Some guys just are just really shy about their testicles getting smaller when they use testosterone, which is totally understandable. And HCG can help remedy that particular situation.
Gotcha. And HCG has a protein moiety that is the same as luteinizing hormone, right? And so you get, that's where it has the luteinizing hormone effects.
Yeah, it's an LH agonist.
Okay.
Is my understanding of HCG.
Okay. So yes. Doc, kind of trying to weave together your work with veterans with PTSD and the cannabis story, let's maybe talk about that specifically, and then also, how often is HRT getting incorporated in with the cannabis protocol?
Okay, sure. So just to talk a little bit about the cannabis, so primarily, as I said, most of the guys that I'm seeing now are within the military, and the thing that they really suffer from, as everyone knows, is post-traumatic stress disorder. So post-traumatic stress disorder, when you're a veteran, there's really two major symptoms that I see from them. One of them is that they don't leave their house. Like, these guys will stay in their house like all day, every day. I mean, one of the main questions I ask them is how many days a month you leave their house. And oftentimes it'll be less than 10.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's pretty serious. And then the other thing, of course, is sleep at night. They're not sleeping. So those are the two things that I really try to focus on initially. We know that cannabis can help with both of them. So, and you can cut me off here if I get into too much detail.
Go wild.
Okay. So in the daytime, I always recommend CBD strains to a lot of my patients because it doesn't have the cognitive effect, and you can still get a huge drop in your anxiety level. Now, THC can cause a drop in your anxiety level too, but as we all know, THC can also increase anxiety severely in some people. So a lot of the soldiers really need to stay away from high THC in the daytime and to stick more to CBD in the daytime to really kind of help calm their anxiety. However, there's no way that you can get the best night's sleep possible if you have PTSD without using some type of THC if you're having a really bad episode on that particular night. And a lot of the soldiers will say that higher THC at night is the only thing that really helps them put to sleep. And the reason that I don't mind them having high THC at night and having that cognitive impairment is because they are simply falling asleep. And during the daytime, I want them to have as much of their cognitive faculties as possible. So I try to minimize the THC that's recommended. And I know your question was, how does that tie into the hormones part? So part of it is when we initially start them on cannabis, I can help them get to sleep again. And sometimes that can,
fix almost everything right there. Yeah.
Yeah. On its own. And then, and now we are trying to work in collaboration with another physician to help treat their hormone levels as well. So right now my job is to really just get them out of the house and to sleep at night. So different populations you kind of have different goals for, and when certain people get to a certain level, then you can maybe introduce something else. But right now, if you're not leaving your house and you're not sleeping at night, things like decreased muscle mass are sort of lower on your scale. Everything else is a little bit.
Yeah, because we're dealing with a stunningly high suicide rate and self-medicating with things that aren't improving sleep and improving health. So,
and just a note on that suicide rate. I mean, one of the reasons I got involved in Canada was because we've actually had more soldiers that have committed suicide than actually died in the Afghanistan conflict, which is crazy. And I've heard quotes in the States that it's like 21 vets a day that are committing suicide. So, obviously what these guys see overseas, they're taking back home.
Right.
And it's not being adequately treated in most cases.
Doc, are you using like cannabidiol oils or like what's the administration method with these?
So there's a little bit of an issue in Canada right now, although it's going to come to a halt very, very quickly. I can only issue dried cannabis, but my patients can make it into oils if they want. Mm. So we have had some patients make it into an oil, and they have had a lot of success with it. Now, I've had more civilian patients than veteran patients that have used cannabis oil, and a lot of those patients have had success. And we can talk about cannabidiol or cannabis oil specifically if you wanted to as well.
Yeah, I would love to get into that a little bit, because I don't sure. think that it's on the radar for folks that these things have really interesting immune modulating effects. I mean, the cannabidiol story, the cannabis story in general, is really fascinating, and you know, cancer treatment, PTSD, epilepsy, like a lot of the things that we look towards, say, like ketogenic diets as a therapeutic agent, the cannabidiol is really analogous there, you know, modulating immune response. There seem to be some anti-aging properties to it. Yeah, definitely fill us all in on that.
Okay, so I think the things that your audience would be interested in terms of cannabidiol is that, one is that I found that a lot of my patients have had a reduced hemoglobin A1C, like it's lowering their insulin levels. And this has been shown too in literature. I think it was a 2013 Harvard study that showed that patients who use cannabis on average had lower insulin levels, and ironically, they had a lower BMI. So that's one, you know, really potent property about cannabidiol, is that it could potentially really help with metabolic syndrome, because it can help control blood sugar levels.
Right.
And there's another, I'll come back to CBD in a second, cannabidiol, but there's actually another cannabinoid that we've identified, hasn't really been brought into the forefront yet, but THCV, and that's supposed to have some anorexic properties to help people not eat as much at night. But coming back to cannabidiol, the other thing that it can do as well, as I touched on just briefly earlier, is that it can really decrease that cognitive impairment, and also that paranoia type of effect that you can get if you do use THC. So that's another big thing it can do. And everyone these days is suffering from some type of anxiety, and cannabidiol is fantastic for anxiety. And the way that it works actually is that it acts on your 5-HT1A receptor. And that's the way that it works. A lot of people think that it's that there's two cannabis receptors, and that just attaches to CBD2, but that's actually not the way that it works in terms of lowering your anxiety. It actually works on your 5-HT1A receptor, and that's the way it works there. So I don't know if those were the main properties that you want to go with cannabis. The other one too, actually, Rob, that you'd probably be interested in is inflammation.
That was my next question, like IBS, Crohn's, like it's amazing for that.
Actually, yeah. I'm happy you asked me about this too, because especially the IBS. So there's something called clinical endocannabinoid deficiency. So some people really just do not have enough cannabinoids in their system. And like I had a patient this morning, and they'll say that their migraine, like it doesn't come down from a 10 to a 2 or 10 to a 1. They'll say it comes down from a 10 to a 0. And for patients like that, you got to think that they are literally just deficient in certain cannabinoids. And it's been linked to fibromyalgia. I know not everyone is happy with that particular diagnosis. It's been linked to IBS, and it's been linked to migraines. So I think that we should really be investigating whether or not, you know, some people that come in and see us, where they really have a endocannabinoid deficiency. And I don't know of any way for testing that right now, other than just having your patient try it and see if they improve. But if someone's improving, you know, from like a 10 to a 0, then you got to think that they were just deficient.
Right. And folks may not be aware that we can have essentially the analogous experience in our gut as what we have in our brain with regards to a migraine, like the alterations in serotonin, dopamine, and whatnot, and then these kind of uncomfortable consequences with vasodilation, vasoconstriction, that can happen in the gut as well, which I would guess that this is some of what the cannabidiols are mitigating.
Yeah, I mean, we know that it helps at every level of inflammation, and it's across all neurological diseases, and it's really been across a lot of inflammatory diseases. So we absolutely know that CBD is a potent anti-inflammatory.
Doc, curious, what's the position of the Canadian military with their soldiers using the cannabinoids? In the U.S., again, it's they'll send you to NICO and they'll do $1 million workup on these guys that have PTSD. They'll send them back with a literally like a small, backpack of pharmaceuticals, which the workup is amazing. What they end up giving these guys is pretty much a waste of time. But if they were to test positive for any type of cannabinoids, that person's career is done. What's the status of that in the Canadian military?
So in Canada right now, actually, it's very, very different. So if you're in the military, it's still very, very frowned upon. However, if you've left the military, it's a lot different. Because Health Canada, if you can believe it or not, they actually cover veterans for up to 10 grams of cannabis a day. Huh. So if you're a veteran in Canada and you suffer from PTSD, you're covered for up to 10 grams of cannabis a day. And they're the only group in Canada that's been covered. And I know 10 grams is a ton. And trust me, I know, because our family medicine guidelines say not to use more than 3, and our CPSO guidelines say not to use more than 5. But now these guys who have serious PTSD, sometimes they need to eat a lot of it, so that'll take up a lot more. And they just have the worst symptoms, right? And they're not using it mostly for PTSD. Most of these guys are using it for chronic pain and for other things as well. And unfortunately, for pain and sleep are the two things that I found with my patients, edibles are much, much better.
Superior.
For.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Particularly sleep, because it needs to stay in your system. Because if you're just gonna, I mean, there's nothing wrong with vaporizing. There's very minimal effects on the lungs there, but still, it's not gonna stay in your system for very long, so it may not be effective for sleeping at night.
Gotcha. Wow, interesting. So yeah, I mean, it sounds again like Canadians win, 1, U.S. 0 on yet another topic related to that.
Well, I don't know, because you guys have more legalization than we do, though. We don't have any.
That is a fascinating thing. So, like, cannabidiol oil you can order off of Amazon in the U.S.
That's crazy.
So that is kind of a wacky thing. So, it's like we just... Man. Man, but it's changing. I mean, it's actually changing. All this stuff is changing much more rapidly than what I thought I would see in my whole lifetime.
Yeah. So, I mean, and that presents a challenge to all of us, isn't it? It's presenting a challenge to me now, because my industry that I work in is changing, and I need to change with it.
Right.
That's just the reality of what I'm forced to be in now. But I love the industry, and I want to keep going with it.
Doc, what about your own kind of regimen, supplements, nutrition, and all that type of stuff? Like, how give us maybe a typical day, maybe stretching out to a week. You mentioned you lift some weights, do a little bit of hockey and whatnot. But what's your chow look like? What are your supplements? Why are you taking the supplements? And maybe just run folks a little bit through that.
Sure. Okay, so every morning when I have a pretty set morning routine, but every morning when I wake up, there's three things that I always do initially. This doesn't quite relate to the supplements, but I always do at least 5 to 10 minutes on my heart rate variability monitor training. So I do that for 5 to 10 minutes, and then I'll usually write in my gratefulness journal for at least another few minutes. And then I usually try to read one passage from something that's very positive, or even from like there's a book actually, Motivation Manifesto, that I read earlier this year. And sometimes I read just small passages from that. Then after that, when I get into my supplements, I take a probiotic on an empty stomach every day. I take vitamin D. I take fish oil. I don't necessarily take all of these in the morning at one time, but I'll take whey protein, some grass and whey protein. Creatine is a supplement that I take, and ashwagandha. So those are the main things that I take. But in terms of my diet, when I start off, I usually have coffee. Sometimes I'll do the bulletproof coffee where I'll put in the butter and the MCT oil. Sometimes I don't do that. And generally around noon or so, I'll have my big, huge super shake that I call it, where I put in a bunch of different leafy greens, some apple cider vinegar, and a bunch of different things just to kind of keep me going throughout the day. Then a little later on, I always have my favorite meal. I have a ton of eggs. I'll go easily through 2 dozen eggs a week. So I'll have 4 or 5 eggs in the afternoon. And then generally I'm playing a sport later on. Like today I'm playing hockey. Before I play hockey, sometimes I will allow myself to have some gluten-free oats, a little bit of stevia. I find that to be okay. That's probably, there's only 3 like carbs I really eat: gluten-free oats, potatoes, and a little bit of organic jasmine white rice. That's pretty much it. So then after hockey, I usually have, or workout, I'll have another shake. Usually then I don't put too much in. So I might just have a few berries and then another scoop of whey. And then I have my kind of like my big meal at the end of the day. So that's when I generally have grass-fed beef, probably almost more days than I don't. And then just a big load of vegetables, and then either some sweet potatoes or some jasmine rice. And that's more or less what I eat throughout the day.
Nice. So, yeah, I mean, you're doing a little bit of a mild fast with that. You're not getting many calories in early. It's pretty light eating with your initial shake and whatnot, and then backloading the bulk of your calories later in the day.
Yeah, and that's what helps me. And, like, it doesn't work for everybody, and I totally understand that. But, you know, intermittent fasting and these types of diets, they really, really work for me, you know. And so I don't really want to change anything right now, because you know, I have really good energy and things are going well.
Oh, that's awesome. And you know, when you're just super busy, I think, do you know the strength coach Dan John?
Really solid dude.
And he made an interesting observation, which was when your life is you know, really, really constrained, busy, then, you know, there's certain areas that need to be really tight also, and usually nutrition and stuff like that. Like, that all goes in together. But then I see, like, going to play hockey, that's a more open-ended activity. You know, it's not like you're just drilling hockey, or you're not going to you know, like, guitar practice or something, and you're doing yet another, like, structured drilling kind of gig. But it seems like when your life is super busy, that, you know, the busyness kind of extends down to the food, and you just kind of have to simplify like crazy. And then interestingly, if your life's a little more relaxed, you've got a lot more latitude just psychologically, psychically, to be able to have a little more latitude and spaz out on your meals a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. I found that this is what's helped with me over the past couple of years. And I'm always open to reinterpretation, but a lot of people will find that if they eat lighter earlier in the day, they'll have a little bit more energy, which is, you know, contrary to what a lot of us have been told. But then again, you know, everything that works for one person doesn't work for everyone else. But I have received a lot of good feedback about intermittent fasting and that type of diet.
Right, right. Particularly, it seems like you are the place that I've seen folks get into deep water with that is if they're training, particularly something like CrossFit, and they're trying to do that in their fasted window. And it seems like you can get some HPTA axis, you know, adrenal fatigue type stuff rearing its head pretty quickly. So, yeah.
I train really hard and I don't eat carbs, after 4 or 5 days, I basically just feel like complete shit.
Right. Shocker. Yeah.
Yeah.
Shocker. Yeah. I know there's some people who are pulling that off, but I again, have not cracked that nut. I've been doing, I guess, something not totally dissimilar. We usually do dinner around 5 o'clock because the girls go to bed pretty early. So I get up early because the girls get up early, and I start cooking some stuff. Now that it's getting into winter, I do this nutty hot cereal, which is basically blending up like a couple of cups of almonds and a couple of apples, and it very fat heavy, but a little bit of carbs in there. And I'll blend that up, puree it, cook it just like oatmeal, have a couple of pieces of bacon. But I usually won't have that until about like 10, maybe 11 a.m. Like that's my first meal. I have a half calf coffee before that. And so I'm getting about a 16, 17 hour fast with that. And then I usually do some jujitsu around 1 or 2 p.m. And then I do actually my big carb and kind of caloric content meal after that. And then I get home from all that stuff, play with the kids, help with dinner. And then dinner is usually more protein and veggies. And then depending on what I did that day and maybe what I'm doing the next day, I might have a little sweet potato or something like that, you know, just a little bit more carbs to top things off. But that's been a pretty good middle ground for me. Cognitively, I feel really good, ketotic. I haven't been able to crack my performance nut completely on that, but that middle ground seems to work well. I have good cognition, pretty good recovery, good performance while rolling and doing my conditioning work. And that's been kind of my middle ground there.
Yeah. It sounds like, so the big difference, I think, between, your diet and my diet, that you eat a lot of your carbs, I guess, after that workout, which obviously makes a lot of sense because your insulin would be really sensitive then. But yeah, I tend to eat mine later on in the night.
Right.
That's the way that things have worked out for me, and I don't really want to switch it right now.
I wouldn't blame you. I get that way too. When things start working, I'm just kind of like, okay, please don't let me go on a trip. Don't let me get sick.
Yes.
Don't
change anything. Exactly.
Awesome, Doc. Well, it's been fantastic having you on the show again. I'm just so appreciate the work that you're doing, and just very, very excited for the changes that are occurring, you know, talking about, you know, we talked in the last show too about ethnogens and psychoactive substances. And, you know, it seems like some cracks in the wall are occurring with that. There's definitely some cracks in the wall with regards to cannabis usage. And all of these things seem to be getting out to the folks much more rapidly, to the folks that really need them. You know, this military population is so underserved and really so incredibly impacted from the work that they do. And a lot of the tools being used are substandard. There's a lot of money actually thrown at it, but I think we could get a much further using some simpler tools that have more natural or integrative effects, you know. And this is one of the interesting things with cannabis. It affects a lot of things in a synergistic and beneficial fashion. And so we tend not to see these negative side effects that we see from a lot of pharmaceuticals.
Absolutely. And just one quick note on that, Rob, too. There was a meta-analysis that came out this year, 2015, I think February, March sometime. And it said in the study that SNRIs and antidepressants, SSRIs, they're all largely ineffective for treating PTSD. Mm-hmm. They said there was a couple that showed a very small beneficial effect, but basically for the most part, they're ineffective. And when you think about it, PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, is significantly different from generalized anxiety or depression. And a lot of these guys and girls are being put on antidepressants and anti-anxiety drugs where there's not a medication that was made for PTSD. And a lot of these patients, a lot of the military are doing much, much better on cannabis. And there's evidence to show that as well. If you do a search on PubMed, there's lots of evidence to show that cannabis is helping.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's exciting times. Like I said, I didn't think I would live to see some of the changes that are occurring. So that's very exciting. Doc, do you do any speaking? Where can folks track you down in real life, or where can they find you on the interwebs?
Well, ironically, actually, I did some speaking last night, but these are more local, just like Canadian Medical Association accredited things. But I'm hoping to do more speaking in the future. But as of right now, if you want to find anything that I'm doing, you can find me online at drmikehart.ca. I post some blogs every now and then there. I also have a Facebook page that I use a little bit, but mostly I'm using my Twitter. My Twitter handle is at drmikehart. So it's drmikehart. So that's where I post most of the findings that I have on cannabis and testosterone and everything else that we've discussed today.
And I follow you religiously, so
I follow you all the time. Yeah.
Awesome, Doc. Well, it's been great having you on the show. Let's circle back again in a couple months and get you back on here and talk about some more stuff.
Well, that'd be great, Rob. I really appreciate you having me on the show, and I'd love to be on again sometime. And I want to thank all your viewers and listening for listening to us today.
Thank you, Doc. We'll talk to you soon.
Okay. Have a great day, Rob.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.